Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Good afternoon, good evening, good whatever, and welcome to the Lawrence Dallaglio being sent off and the USA scoring immediately afterward retrospective podcast, the Squidge Rugby podcast spin-off thing, where we will talk about all the rugby that happened in the USA's game against England from the 2007 World Cup, and I just described it to you right there, because the rest of it was rancid. I am joined, as ever, by Mr. Will Owen. How are you doing?
I'm alright, thank you, but mainly because I've given myself a bit of distance from this game. We didn't record this immediately after watching it, so I think I'm doing a little bit better mentally, you know?
Yeah, I think I am largely forgetting large chunks of the game. Yeah. Because it's a few hours since I watched it, and it was properly atrocious.
Yeah. It felt like being back in 1987 to me.
It really did. Like, that was the big thing I couldn't get away from. Yeah. Was how much it felt. It's like how people always talk about how they want... There's always this request on Twitter and so on, and you see it every time they announce a new rugby game. People go, well, why don't they just do Jonah Lomu Rugby and make it exactly the same, but just, like, update the graphics and the teams? And you're like, Jonah Lomu Rugby is not unplayable, but it's...
It's not great. It's
aged but a lot.
I think the point you're trying to make is this does very much feel like a revamped version of the game from 1987.
Yeah, like they reskinned it and gave everyone nicer kits. Well, not nicer kits, but like more professional athlete standard kits.
Absolutely.
Rather than the cotton shirts.
Yeah, because we've had, like, we did the 2011 World Cup, which we both loved, right? Mm. And we did some shit games in there. There were some shit games in there. But this felt different. This felt like an outlier in shit games.
I think this is a contender for the worst game we've covered on this podcast.
Really? I mean, it can't be far off. It's got to be top 10, hasn't it? I think there was a couple of games from 87. We've done this before, but the Welsh games in 87 were
atrocious.
Pretty
poor. England-Argentina was very bad in 2011.
Yeah.
And same with Georgia-Romania, but at least those games were closer than this was.
Yeah. Because you never thought the USA were going to do anything threatening in this
game.
No. Like, you've got to respect the fact that they kept the score down and so on.
Yeah,
You know, it was a relatively close game in the end. That, to spoil it, England win the game 28 points to 10. Like, they don't get the bonus point. They score 3 tries in the end. Yep. And that in itself is respectable for the USA because they don't want this game to be entertaining, do they?
No.
They want this game to be respectable and close, and they want to play well. It's not the players or the referees or any of the coaches. It's not anybody's responsibility to make the game entertaining for us. The only people who's responsible for that is the broadcasters, which we'll come on to.
You do sound like Razzie Erasmus, but yes, I agree.
Yes. The thing about this is the USA obviously keep the score down and everything, but in attack, when they have the ball, they are dog shit.
Oh, I mean, we'll get onto this as we go, but I mean, both teams are bad in attack, but the USA are pretty spectacular.
Yeah. Like, I think the first time they had the ball, I wanted to, like, cash out on wanting them to win, if that makes sense. Because naturally, right, as a Welsh fan, every time I see an England playing an underdog, I go, oh yeah, underdog time.
Yeah, and I almost always support the underdogs. You know, if it's not Wales playing, I will almost always support the underdogs no matter what.
But I tell you what, like, speaking objectively, I was very aware of this England team as one that... Mm. The narrative around this World Cup is that they were quite shit, right?
Yes.
And I always thought people were kind of exaggerating that. I never believed people when they said that. I always thought they were exaggerating quite a lot.
Because they make the final.
They make the final. They won the previous World Cup and have a lot of the same players. We'll come on to the England team, right? But I think their first team has a lot of really good players in it.
Yeah.
Their first team specifically has a lot of really good players in it. But yeah, I always thought that was exaggerated. And I watched this and I was like, maybe they're not so great, but they're the lesser of two evils in this particular 80-minute segment.
Yeah, and so it's a really interesting point in sort of English rugby. There's a thing that friend of the pod, Lee Calvert, has always said, that England are the worst world champions in any sport, that 2003 to 2007 England team, because they immediately went to being shit.
Yeah.
Like, they kind of dropped off a cliff completely. There was a quote I came across, and I've forgotten who it's from. I think it was Ian Robertson, the former commentator, who said 2003's team was known as Dad's Army. This lot's even older. And it was kind of taken as, like, this England team are well past their best. They kind of hit, like, the end of their prime in 2003, and now they're beyond it. They immediately kind of went off a cliff in 2004, 2005, as we saw them lose to, except for Italy, lost to every Six Nations team over this kind of period.
Yeah.
They did not perform consistently at all, but they would have odd games where things would start to look pretty good again.
You have a point. Like, this does feel like an England team who just looks like a load of people's uncles, doesn't it?
Yes.
That's kind of the vibe of it. There's a lot of nostalgic, like, premiership-y names that crop up in this team.
Get into the team, but yeah. So, England played 4 World Cup warm-ups coming into this.
Okay.
They battered Wales in both of those games.
I recall.
And they lost to France in both of those games.
Right.
So, you know, bit of a different vibe. Kind of told them where they were standing.
Yeah.
It was described as kind of disastrous World Cup warm-ups in a lot of cases by the fact that they were losing 15-21 to France at Twickenham and then 22-9 away, with Johnny Wilkinson getting injured in that second away game.
Yes.
And then leading on to missing. I mean, this game, there was a lot of talk on will he make it, will he not in the lead up, and boy, he did not.
No. But so they spoke about in the World Cup opening non-ceremony, as we coined it. They spoke a lot about Johnny Wilkinson and his injury and so on. And they also spoke about England's kind of title contention hopes. And they were talking a lot as though England actually had a chance, which is, again, another reason why I thought it's probably bollocks that they were actually terrible the whole time.
Yeah.
But it might be that they set the bar too high, which is often a thing that the RFU and English rugby do when it comes to World Cups, that they kind of expect to win every single one. And you know what? That's not a bad thing.
And in some ways England should, because they are the team with the most resources.
They are.
You know?
They are.
It's not a terrible prediction.
No.
They had, as we made this point repeatedly when doing this podcast, a lot of parallels to the current situation, to where we are, you know, heading in just before the 2023 World Cup, also in France. And of course, one of them is that A, Andy Robinson had been fired, and B, England had fired their coach. So Andy Robinson had been head coach of England. He was fired in the December, before the World Cup, after losing to Argentina at home at Twickenham was what did it. Which, I don't know if that sounds familiar to anyone.
It does. And it makes you wonder what Andy Robinson said about the private school system that the RFU have in place.
That really got under their skin.
Yeah.
Really changed things. He was fired, he went, and Brian Ashton, who was very much, there was a lot of people's favourite, a lot of people wanted him to take the job after Clive Woodward instead. He'd been the attack coach under Clive Woodward from 1998 to 2002. And that included the period in kind of 2001, 2002, where England played a lot of their best rugby under Clive Woodward.
Yeah.
And in 2003, they went very hard into the kicking game and into Wilkinson and into the drop goals. Which won them the World Cup. But like the year beforehand, they were playing far more expansive rugby. They were playing some really great rugby that kind of sort of destroyed New Zealand, put up some record score lines. Like, a lot of people consider that the best period in English rugby was that kind of year just before the World Cup. And then they almost were running out of steam by the time they got to the World Cup, and they took that Wilkinson drop goal to get them there. And Ashton had been the attack coach, he'd been a huge part of that.
Let me tell you, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know he was the attack coach of, like, the most exciting rugby they've played, looking at this.
So he then left to become the National Academy manager instead of the attack coach. Mm-hmm. So he managed all the academies across the country for a few years, and then went to coach Bath and became Bath's head coach and did a pretty good job there. Meanwhile, Andy Robinson took over and,
Didn't go quite his way.
No. So Clive Woodward continued after the 2003 World Cup. He continued on, did the following Six Nations, did the tour of Australia, which was contracted for the end of the season following the World Cup. For some reason, sort of thing they wouldn't do nowadays, but it was back in those days where you were contracted through to the end of the season rather than the end of the World Cup cycle.
Yeah.
And that was very much how they did it at the time.
Yeah, and it was slightly less tailored towards the Beale and Endel of international rugby just being World Cups at that stage.
Yeah,
yeah. It kind of has become the trend.
I think
now.
The 2003 World Cup was the start of that. I think it was the start of people viewing that as a cycle you build up to.
In fairness, Clive Woodward deserves a lot of credit for that.
Yeah.
Because he did tailor everything towards that tournament and, you know, making sure that they were the best prepared, most professional team that there were out there. And at the time in 2003, which according to him it still is, that was quite revolutionary in rugby. Not many others yeah. were doing that. Whereas now everybody obviously is, you know, as soon as someone does something well, everyone catches on.
A lot of that was him absolutely bombing out in the 99 World Cup and doing terribly
yeah.
in the way Eddie Jones didn't in his first World Cup.
Yeah.
And yet here we are. So yeah, he then took over, coached the following Six Nations where, as I said, like England lost to Ireland, they lost to France. They just about beat Wales and Scotland, so good on them. That's where their standards should be. And then lost unanimously 3 games in a row to Australia. At which point, Clive Woodward goes off to coach the Lions, which goes really well for him.
Yeah.
And really cements his reputation as rugby's greatest coach.
It goes really well for him. It was 3-0, that Lions tour, wasn't it?
Yep.
That's a really good result for someone.
But Andy Robinson takes over England instead. And do you know what? His first game in charge, right, gets a massive 70-0 win. Like, he's going really, really well.
Okay.
The game's against Canada, but that doesn't matter. They then proceed to lose again to Australia, and in the following Six Nations is a bit of a disaster, right? They lose to Wales in Cardiff, they lose to France in Twickenham, they then lose to Ireland away again. They manage to scrape it back towards the end, and they just about beat Scotland and beat Italy. But it's all not going too well. Then the following year, they build in and the results get even worse. He goes on to win only 3 games over the 12 they play that year, which is a familiar number, I think, to Wales fans.
Certainly.
Less so to Eddie. You know, he still had a significantly worse record than Eddie Jones. Eventually, you know, retired with 22 games played, 9-1, which is a terrible record for world champions. Andy Robinson.
Yeah.
So
the amount of pressure that must have been on them. Like, if you think of our current world champion, South Africa, like, when they lose one game, the uproar that goes on, like, yeah. around kind of not just their supporters, but like their coaching staff and the playing staff and everything, like, they obviously feel a pressure on them of world champions. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's a compliment to them. But for Robinson to come away from that with, as I say, a very good group of players and some. that's quite startling.
Yeah. So that autumn, they lost 41-20 to New Zealand, 18-25 to Argentina, and 14-25 to South Africa. Can I offer you a quick quiz question?
Go on.
So during the summer, right, they played Australia. They played 2 series against Australia in 1 World Cup cycle. There we go. Who was the England captain during that period?
What year were we talking?
2006.
Was it maybe Lawrence Dallaglio?
It was not Lawrence Dallaglio.
Oh, was it maybe Martin Johnson?
It was not Martin Johnson. He was retired by this point.
Oh, I'm not sure. Who was captain from that era? I mean, Phil Vickery is the captain in this game, but I'm assuming it's not him?
It was not him.
Who was it then?
The captain for the Six Nations was Martin Corrie.
Okay.
Right? But for the summer tour, it was Pat Sanderson.
No.
England's summer tour captained by Pat Sanderson. Looking at this team, it's actually stronger than the one eventually played in the World Cup. But still Ollie Barkley at 10.
Wow. Who are some of the players that didn't make it as far as the World Cup that they had playing for?
Ian Bolshaw.
Okay, yeah.
They're back three, right? Ian Bolshaw at fullback, Tom Vandell on one wing,
wow.
Tom Voice on the other.
Tom Voice, remember him?
Yep.
I knew he had an England career, but I thought of him as an extremely club player.
Yeah. Lee Mears, crisp salesman, starting.
Wow, okay. Presumably, this is while he was still building up his business as well.
Yeah. He was very early on. He was only selling crumbs at this point.
Oh, wow, okay. And he's probably only making like 4p per crumb rather than... In fact, that probably works out a bit
really,
stronger than
really good.
11p per crisp.
Yeah, no, he wasn't getting much success selling crumbs for 4p.
Yeah.
Not many people were buying that, even in Bath in the noughties. So yeah, so England in a weird place, Andy Robinson doing terribly, they fire him, they bring in Brian Ashton, they're like, brilliant, we've solved all of our problems, but Brian Ashton arrives and has to look at the players he's got.
As I say though, there are some genuinely like world-class players in this England squad, but today we have to talk about this game, which is unfortunate, and the players they picked for this game.
So, should we move on to... should we even talk about the USA?
Yeah, the USA, what kind of position were they in, do you know?
Weird one. I think very much in a kind of rebuilding phase that had taken slightly too long.
Right.
This was not a vintage USA team, I think it's fair to say.
No. I think there's a lot of really good players who go on to do really good things, but they're all quite young. Like, you've got Chris Wiles made his test debut earlier this year in a game against England A, funnily enough. You've got players like that, like, we'll come on to this, but Takudzo Ngwenya makes his first test cap in this game. Same with Martin Moyakiola. Like, Mike McDonald's in there, but is hardly in the end of his playing days at this point.
Yeah.
Same with Paul Emerick. Like, there's a lot of players in this team who go on to have like quite successful careers after this, but they're a long way off their prime.
So the majority of their team was amateur at this point.
Okay.
If you look through that team, there's a few of them that were doing contracts at the back of that, as you mentioned, like Wiles and Nguenya and so on. Mm. Paul Emerick as well. And you have a handful of players like Mike McDonald at Leeds. You had Mike Hercus, who just signed for after this World Cup. He went from the Scarlets to the Dragons. You have a few players like that. You have, just before this game, right before kickoff, Luke Gross pulls out, who was a second row who... I mean, so Luke Gross's career is fascinating. In the end, the injury picks up in the warm-up, rules him out the tournament, which is
that's unfortunate.
But
he was their most capped player of all time at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not familiar with him. I think I've heard his name. But
with 62 caps.
That's fantastic for the day he was playing in.
So,
the USA.
So Luke Gross, right? He was on a basketball scholarship at Indiana State University, right? And then later Marshall University, which he moved to because he was good at basketball, right?
Okay.
He then graduates from university and goes, well, he wasn't, you know, he was good enough to be like a really good standard university basketballer, but not good enough to get like an NBA contract or anything. So then just goes like, well, I'll try some other sports. Takes up rugby, and inside like a few weeks, right, of taking up rugby and just playing a little bit with the Cincinnati Wolfhounds.
What a team.
He is spotted by a man called Dick Best.
Dick Best.
Who was the head coach at Harlequins at the time.
Okay.
This was in 1997.
Dick Best.
He spots him on like his fifth game of rugby and goes, he's good, brings him over and signs him for Quins, where he plays six games.
Wow. Hell of an impression he must have
yeah.
made. He must have been such a natural talent in every sport.
Yeah,
That's what that tells me. And he must have played a bit of...
Do you know what else football. He was?
What?
6 foot ten.
That certainly helps.
Yeah. Being a second row at 6 foot ten. He then goes on to, you know, play a bit for Rovigo and Roma in Italy before signing for the Scarlets. Plays 9 games for the Scarlets in one season there. Goes to Rotherham, goes to Newcastle, goes to Doncaster, goes to Sheffield. Bounces around.
Great kinda, clubman rating on him.
Absolutely. Bounces around a bit before starting coaching, ending up as the head coach of the Sacramento Express.
Sacramento Express Pro Rugby. What a team. Didn't they have... Was it Sacramento Express who had Viliami Yonghi playing for them?
Yes. No, they didn't. I'm afraid they didn't.
Oh.
They had Mirko Bergamasco playing for them, though.
They did.
In the centres.
No doubt scoring loads of tries, because that's the double life he lives now.
So, yeah, that's sort of Luke Gross. He was not playing.
Mm-hmm.
He withdrew, leaving, the USA with a team who had not had a great lead into this tournament. So they played pre this in 2007 in the Churchill Cup and in a couple of warm-up matches. In the Churchill Cup, they lost 51-3 to the England Saxons.
Oh, so that was the Chris Wilds debut game, right?
I guess it must have been, yeah.
Yeah, that's really not boding well for either team when England A are pumping USA and yet England aren't.
It's very telling, isn't it?
Yeah.
You had Dylan Armitage, Topsy Ojo, like the names in that. Ryan Lamb playing at 10.
Wow. It is England Saxons after all.
Yep.
Was Paul Hodgson playing?
I don't think so.
Ah. Oh.
So England scored 9 tries and Ryan Lamb only got 3 of the conversions.
3 out of 9, a proper Andy Robinson record there.
Nice. Yeah, the USA also played Scotland A, where they lost 13-9 to sole try by Rory Lamont in the second half.
Ah.
That was kind of their big standout performance of the year. They got beaten 52-10 by Canada. They lost to Munster in a warm-up game.
They're not in a good place.
They're not in a great, ideal place. As I say, mostly an amateur team. They were kind of punching above their weight. They'd, you know, come through in qualifying all right, and then were looking at getting to the World Cup rather than, you know, pushing on and challenging there.
Which
it wasn't
even doing
USA
now,
team, I think.
To be fair. So.
But let's say, as we said before, like, there's an awful, like, Mike Petrie's on the bench and doesn't get on. Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of really good players that will go on to have great careers for the USA that are just starting out here.
I believe that would have been his first cap, Mike Petrie, as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, as you say, there's a lot of really good players. We're talking the pre-Scully era of the of USA rugby, so it's never going to be quite the vintage era of USA rugby that we've seen before. But, like, yeah, so
Should we look at the USA team first?
Looking at the USA team, I think the standout player in there is the captain, Mike Hercus. He's probably the most experienced professional player, has played a few years of the Scarlets, and was a bit of a fan favourite
before that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And a good goal kicker. Great rugby 04 player, Mike Hercus. But he's probably the most standout player at the time for the USA. But you also have in the team, Mike McDonald went on to have a great tournament in 2011, as we've previously discussed. Chris Wiles is one of their greatest players of all time. Was captain for them, got 50-plus caps, got like 2,000 caps for Saracens. Was a brilliant player. As I say, Tokudzwa and Gwenya. Look more at him as the tournament goes along, but you can tell looking at this that they have identified he has pace and they haven't yet figured out how to use it. But yeah, he's a brilliant player who we both, I assume, have great memories of watching in his day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and some horrible memories as well.
Yeah, that too. That too. I'm skinning Shane Williams in the San Sebastian stadium. Yeah, Todd Clever in the team as well is one that... I mean, I'm assuming watching this game, this is far before his kind of prime, before he played in South Africa and so on. He's a great player. We like Todd Clever.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Gets referred to by the commentators as Tom Clever at one point.
Does he? Does he?
I also want to mention one thing about Mike Hercus that we moved on before I could get to. I discovered today he is married to a TV presenter called Natalie Michaels, who used to present MTV, now presents Sky News in Australia.
I did not know that.
Married to Mike Hercus. Good on them.
Good on both of them. I hope that their marriage is serving very happily for them.
Yes.
Anything else on the USA team while we're there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few players that are just like... There's a few really solid players, as I said, like young players who are developing, going to come to something. Paul Emmerich is a sort of player who's probably never young.
Yes. Yeah, he never made a test debut. He always had like at least like 12 caps.
Yeah. I suppose he was still, we say young, he was 27 at this point.
Oh,
just he went on to play for quite a while after this. You know, he played in 2003.
And, you know, had a good kind of professional career. Played in Ireland and England, didn't he?
And Wales.
And Wales. Did he play in Wales?
He played for the Dragons.
Yeah. Wow, I seem to have forgotten about that. Was it very brief in like kind of
43 games for the Dragons.
Oh, you're joking. I can't remember that. I should remember that.
Yeah.
I like Paul Emmerich a lot. But yeah, like, as you say, like, he has a lot of rugby left to play and his best rugby, frankly, you know, yet to play. Yeah, also making his debut off the bench is Martin Moeakiolo, who went on to play in 2011. And they also have a test debut for Henry Bloomfield, who I've never heard of, playing at number 8 for them.
Inaki Bisori as well, who was great on the Rugby World Cup 2011 video game.
Yes.
And had one good game in the 2011 World Cup.
Against Australia.
Scores
and
a try.
Scored? Yeah, absolutely. So.
Oh, no, he didn't score. He passed last minute because he never scored a try for the... Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Created the try.
Oh, yeah, who was the guy... JJ Gaggiano, he's the one who scored.
JJ Gaggiano.
There we go.
What a pull. What a player.
I've not Googled that. I've just remembered
that. No, I saw it across your face. It was an incredible thing
So they have a hooker called Owen Lentz with a Z on Lentz. And that sounds like a shitty house DJ.
It does. There's no way he's a real rugby player.
Like, he should be opening for Steve Aoki. We all know that.
He played for South Africa at under 21s, then shifted to the USA.
Right.
Played for the Maryland Exiles.
That's not a real team. That's honestly, an unlicensed rugby challenge
at
team.
At some point, I could go full Sandy Lomb and just make up a team that a USA team played for.
Honestly, if they had MLR in Rugby Challenge but didn't get the licenses for the teams, we are pretty much rattling them off here.
Do we do it? Do we move on to the England team?
I think we do. So, I referred in a previous episode to the fact that this World Cup was mentioned by a friend of the podcast, Josh Gardner, as the Sean Perry World Cup. Which really stood out to me. I could see the distress on your face
so,
as you record this.
The moment I put the game on to watch it, and the first thing that comes up is England team sheet.
Yeah.
I turned my iPad back off because I didn't want to look at it again. I went, Jesus Christ, and wheezed when I looked at that back line. It's one of the most horrible things I've ever had to look at. You can't... I want to just read it out so we can...
Okay, should we just read it out 1 to 15?
Should we alternate?
Okay.
So...
Okay.
At fullback is Mark Cueto.
Indeed. A solid winger sometimes, Mark Cueto. Playing at fullback, you must think that the wingers must be really renowned wingers, and specifically wingers. So on the right wing, we have Josh Lucy, World Cup winning fullback.
And on the left wing, we have Jason Robertson, World Cup winning fullback.
Yep. Very strange order to do that in. In the centres, we have Mike Catt and Jamie Noon.
And as half... Jamie Noon. And as halfbacks, we have Ollie Barkley and Sean Perry.
I will give you my reaction to that once we run through the team. Front row, Andrew Sheridan, Mark Regan, Phil Vickery, captain.
Which is all right. The second row,
good.
Ben Kay and Simon Shaw.
That's class.
That's great.
That is like a world-class second row partnership. Yeah. And then back row, Joe Worsley, Tom Rees, Lawrence Dallaglio.
Lawrence Dallaglio at this point was, of course, aged 35.
Okay.
Very much in the twilight of his career, had initially intended to retire before this World Cup, and then last minute was kind of thrown back in.
Mm-hmm. On the bench, while we're here, we have George Shooter, Matt Stevens, Martin Curry, Lewis Moody, Peter Richards, Andy Farrell and Matthew Tate, a very young Matthew Tate. Now, it's interesting that you said when you saw that team, your instinct was to just switch the iPad off.
Yeah.
Like, I can't do
this.
I'm
not doing this.
So that is your way of grieving. My way of grieving looking at this England team was to text Lee Calvert, friend of the pod. Just to let him know that I was watching this. He's a fan of vintage England. Some of the retro players. And when I say a fan, it might mean he doesn't rate them as players. I think it's very much his niche is that sort of player. Mm. Like the Sean Perrys of the world. So I asked him for an opinion on this back line. And what he had to say was, Quaito was furiously competent. Noon was just bobbins.
That's about right. That about sums it up.
Yeah.
I just want to mention on the Lawrence Dallaglio point as well. Lawrence Dallaglio had retired, then because England were playing so badly, came out of retirement. Like, he announced that autumn he would make himself available for selection again. So, came back out of retirement, played in the Six Nations again, and then went on to play in the World Cup. All of it, like, a year before this, you were not expecting him to be available, never mind to actually play in the World Cup.
And this was before he went to any Romanian nightclubs, as he would call them?
Oh, no, he was doing that well beforehand.
He was doing that well beforehand. Yeah, and having some nice drinks.
Yes, spending 30 grand on drinks.
Yeah, and typically that's when Lawrence Dallaglio goes out, we all know this, when he likes to let his hair down, he exclusively uses drinks
The very interesting thing about Lawrence Dallaglio and Mike Catt, right, mm-hmm. is that Lawrence Dallaglio had, prior to this World Cup, already published an autobiography while he was still playing, but when he thought he was retired from England.
Okay.
In which he was incredibly critical of Brian Ashton. Mike Catt then backed up everything he'd said.
Oh, no.
Dallaglio then sees England in a disaster and goes like, I'm going to make myself available for selection. Then Brian Ashton takes over as coach and has to pick him.
Oh, there would have been an interesting meeting around that with the three of them sat in a room. Brian Ashton sitting them down, just getting the book and going, what the fuck is this? And then Lawrence Dallaglio going like, I know, I stand by it all, but I am your best number eight. Yeah, fair enough. You're in.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So yeah, so it was all a bit up in the air, weird situation for England. When you look at that team, right, the front five is really quite good.
It's brilliant, yeah.
You've got...
Phil Vickery is a multiple Lion.
Yep.
And a deserved one at that. World Cup winner, world-class tired prop.
Yeah.
Phil Vickery. One of the best tires that will come up
in
this tournament.
One
no
of the best of the kind of prop that, like, Tom Ferrand is a really good example of it at the minute.
Okay.
It just doesn't go backwards.
Yeah.
Like,
that cornerstone cliche, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. If you exclude the now the most famous game of his career,
yes.
where he gets marmalized by the Beast. He was the kind of prop that wasn't necessarily destructive, but like he just didn't go backwards. He was just solid. Yeah. Like you threw anything at him and he held you out, which is why McGeeken picked him for that game, because he went, well, I can pick Adam Jones, who's a far more destructive scrummager and might cause South Africa problems, but or I can pick the guy that never goes backwards.
And unfortunately, and no way he went backwards.
And he went backwards, it backfired.
Andrew Sheridan as well.
Andrew Sheridan, strong as an ox, for being one of the most powerful rugby players to ever live, got hyped up enormously before this tournament, was like... Yeah. Like, almost the Marcus Smith of his day.
Sure.
He's like the Marcus Smith of front rowers in terms of how hyped up he was.
Yeah, but an excellent player. Like, unbelievably strong. Like, you will rarely see a stronger rugby player than him, you know, as you say. Like, really good carrier and stuff as well. Yeah. Like, I really rate Andrew Sheridan.
And then you have the second row, which Shaw and Kay, both really good players. Both playing great rugby at the time. Ben Kay kind of at the end of his career. This was kind of his swan song. And he was slightly slowed down a bit. But like it wasn't affecting him much.
Yeah.
Like, it was
still a great line-out operator.
Yeah.
Great around the park. Like would hit rucks, do all the selfless shots.
He was slightly less effective than he was a few years earlier when he was one of the top five locks in the world.
Exactly.
You know, it's like he's now one of the top 20, top 15, instead.
And we've spoken a lot about Simon Shaw before. I think that Simon Shaw is a player we both have a soft spot for.
Yeah, after the Lions series.
A favourite English player of both of ours.
Yes.
Because what I really like about Simon Shaw is there is a certain type of second row that you'll see playing second team who is just there because he's fucking massive and he will catch the ball, he will run into people, and he will never ever back down from anything.
Yep.
Simon Shaw is basically the best at that of all time, aside from Bakis Bauta.
Yeah.
Like he's one of the best in the world at that, and I love that about him. And yet he's surprisingly athletic.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It's easy to forget that about Simon Shaw, even in his latter days. Like he still actually had a bit of agility to him, like even when he was seizing up every 2 minutes. Like I've got a lot of time for Simon Shaw.
The other interesting thing in the England team is, of course, on the bench.
Okay.
Where we have, of course, on that bench, Andy Farrell.
We do. We do. And as soon as his name was said, my eyes kind of lit up.
Yes.
I don't know about you. I've never seen Andy Farrell play rugby before. Certainly not rugby union. Because I love rugby league. I'm rugby league scrunch.
You are rugby
I watch
league.
So much rugby league.
Sometimes I wish you'd shut up about rugby league.
Yeah, I know. I should really get around to shutting up about rugby league. But I just love rugby league. Especially Andy Farrell. He's a great rugby league player.
So he made his debut against Scotland at Twickenham in the Six Nations at 12. They mentioned on the commentary, like Sam Burgess of his day.
Yeah.
The debate of whether he should play back row or centre.
Yeah. And looking at when Farrell comes on, looking at him, I don't think he looks like a back row forward at all.
No.
He looks like a centre who can play fly half, which is exactly what he ended up being.
Mm.
I find that mad that they considered him to potentially play back row. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm sure that if he had to fill in there for a half, he would do a job.
Yeah.
Like, because he's massive and obviously he has the whole Hurt Arena thing. So, like, oh, honestly, like, did you see in the last 20 minutes? I didn't see who it was, but there's a point where the USA make a break out of their own 22 and someone in midfield misses a tackle and just clearly just goes into hiding from Andy Farrell.
Like you would.
Because like imagine what Andy Farrell was like as a player in terms of driving standards.
Yeah.
It must have been insane.
Imagine him
level.
In that team after that game.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, his kind of speeches after the game and so on must have been worse than a lot of the coaches.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd hate to be on the same team as him, because if you made a mistake, you're done. You'd know about it.
So we've talked primarily about England so far, right? But I do want to mention the commentary, because it takes them on the video we've got 5.5 minutes before they even mention the USA. Before they mention a player, before they mention anything other than the England's opposition. They'll mention in passing, like, England, of course, playing the USA first, but then they'll play South Africa, and then they'll go on to a World Cup final. And all of this, they don't mention the USA at all. There's absolutely... It was before we even got to kickoff, I had written in my notes, this game reminds me of all the worst things about World Cups.
Yeah.
Rugby World Cups in particular, right? Which is that you have so much coverage leaning only into one side and just peddling bullshit narratives rather than actually looking at the facts, looking at what's going on, looking at the teams in front of them, and namely just looking at one of the two teams.
Yeah, I have a lot of bones to pick about this commentary, right? And that was kind of the first red flag I had.
Mm.
To me, this very much scans as the commentary is done by... And like, I don't want to be unkind about this because people are doing their best, right? And as we've said in previous ones, like, it's not an easy job, right? No. It's not an easy job. But there is something about this that just reeks of somebody who watches rugby every now and then as a passing interest.
Yeah.
And really wants to show that they know about it.
Yeah, it had massive man in the pub energy.
Yeah.
Which was like my big takeaway. It had massive man in the pub who remembers what happened in last year's Six Nations and remembers what happened in the Five Nations in 1998 when he was 12.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever.
I'm not going to say the name of the commentator at the moment because I don't want to sound like it's like, oh, I'm calling you out type thing, because that's not what I want to do. But it's a former professional hammer thrower. Who's usually an athletics commentator and has crossed over to rugby. And it's very clear that rugby's not like his main sport.
Mm.
And that's okay. Like, it isn't Andrew Cotter's main sport.
No.
And yet...
It's the thing that I got from it, though, is that, like, air of false confidence about it that really annoyed me.
Yeah.
Him very, very assuredly talking about this England team and how, what contenders they are and having no interest in the USA team whatsoever.
Yeah.
The first thing we hear about the USA, as I say, is almost 6 minutes in, and he just runs through all the players that aren't born in America in the team.
Yeah. He gets really frustrated about that throughout the game. They have so many non-native players and saying, like, these guys should be playing for Tonga and Samoa.
America is a country fundamentally built on immigration.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, it's the point in the American dream.
There's something to celebrate, man.
Yeah.
Like, and again, like, you know, I tongue-in-cheek say, like, oh, Owen Lentz sounds like a shit DJ. It's cool that they have, like, such a broad spectrum of, like, nationalities and names represented. That's a good thing. And also, like, it's the USA rugby team. You should be happy for them, like, being able to pull in players who have potentially grown up elsewhere and so on. That they can have these kind of players bolster their team. That's a good thing. That's to be celebrated.
Yeah. He also says that England have got coming up the unpredictability of Tonga. Like, we had the same thing in 87 where people would be like, oh, the unpredictable nature of the USA, I think they said, of maybe this fixture when Mike Harrison of Wakefield scored 2 tries.
Of course.
But this Tonga team in 2007 were not unpredictable. Most of their players were playing in Europe, an awful lot of them were at least, and they had been playing pretty consistently against the big teams, and they've been playing big, physical, bone-breaking rugby.
Yeah. It's obviously we'll cover Tonga when we cover Tonga, but that Tonga team is probably heralded as their greatest team of all time.
It's up there.
On paper, it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Like, they play exactly like you can expect. Like, if you look up the Tongan squad from this World Cup, they play exactly as you expect them to. Like, yeah, it's... The other thing is, right, so you, as you say, it takes them 6 minutes to talk about the USA. It's literally as the teams are walking out, he acknowledges, oh, the USA are also there. Mm. He says of Mike Hercus, he does penalties and he also sometimes does conversions. So clearly that's him showing off that he knows that they're things in rugby, penalties and conversions. And then when they sing their national anthem, his immediate follow-up line is, will the land of the brave become the land of rugby? Which sounds like something we would say.
He also starts boasting after that about how I was at the Olympics the other year, and I heard that a lot, let me tell you.
I was expecting that anecdote to go somewhere.
Oh, mate, his anecdote in the second half about his son met Johnny Wilkinson's great.
Wait, remind me of that.
He literally, the anecdote is, my eldest son was doing a fitness test and Johnny Wilkinson was also doing that fitness test and Johnny Wilkinson beat him.
Brilliant.
But he tells it in the most uninteresting way imaginable. It's not, it makes you wish Scott Quinnell was telling it, you know?
But the thing that really annoys me about this commentary is that this guy is so sure in, like, him being so knowledgeable about rugby that he, like, corrects the players' decisions and stuff.
Oh,
and, like,
yeah.
Really criticises them and stuff. And, like, don't get me wrong, as I say, that's partly what we're doing right now as people who have not played high-level rugby. But it's not even with humour behind it or anything.
We've had this conversation before, and there are certain commentators working at the minute that I think this is true of, who I think editorialise and will correct things and will be like, actually a player should have done this when they make a decision. And I don't think that's a commentator's job. I think a commentator's job is to describe, and it's why I don't do commentary and I don't think I'd be a very good commentator.
Yeah, same.
Well, I mean, yeah, I feel it's a world in which I could learn to be good at commentator. I don't think it's what naturally comes to me, you know.
Yeah, I agree with that on my, you know, for myself as well.
Yeah. There was a conversation I had over Christmas and I mentioned this, but I had a conversation with one current commentator about who mentioned they don't have a lot of time for a different current commentator who I think is excellent, who I think both of them are excellent commentators.
Okay.
Because the other one has kind of a more of a personality and this commentator was saying that they didn't believe that commentators should have a bring a personality to a game.
Okay.
Whereas I quite like the other one delivering it in a kind of charming fashion.
Okay.
And I think it's an interesting conversation, but I think whether or not you deliver your lines with a level of, is it, of personality, of kind of charm, is a very different conversation to whether you are correcting the players, whether you're saying this should be this.
Yeah.
There's one commentator in particular at the minute that does this an awful lot, who again I won't necessarily name.
I know who you mean.
Who does? I remember last year this particular commentator, though the one you're thinking of actually is a different commentator. I don't want to get too deep into the slagging off commentators, because I think by and large the commentators on TV are exceptional,
brilliant. I think the standard of commentary is really, really good.
Seeing commentators like this just makes me appreciate how good someone like Nick Mullins is.
Yeah.
Someone like
Mars Harrison,
Nick Heath, who's been on this podcast.
Yeah,
Sean Maloney, Jamie Lyle.
Sarah Orchard's
fantastic.
Yeah.
Claire Thomas at the World Cup. There's so many that we can keep, you know, listing that are excellent.
We're in a great position for that. We've criticised pundits before and so on, but for commentary, we're in a fantastic position. And there's not a lot of stuff like this happening where people are throwing. The thing is, I think that what bugs me is, like, you have the colour commentator for a reason. Mm. They are usually the one that's there to provide the opinions and so on.
Exactly.
And I think that there is criticising a player's decision, but I think that instead of saying they should have done this, you say they could have done this, or they might have thought about doing this.
Well, the only point Eddie Butler used to make of breaking that kind of just describing what's going on and trying to put it as best he can and do it the gravitas, you know, give it the gravitas and do it as, to do it justice, was occasionally he'd say if a pass drifted forward. And that was the only time you ever heard his opinion.
Yeah.
Or occasionally he'd go, oh, dearie me, if someone made a mistake. But he didn't throw any of that in. Bill McLaren didn't throw any of that in when we watched him back on the 87
games. Absolutely.
And he was such great company.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't want a commentator's opinion.
Yeah.
I don't, or no, at least I don't want them to be correcting
stuff. There's a time and a place for it, I think. There's like, someone that came to mind for me a lot, because like I was thinking, like, I really wish this game was being commentated on by someone like Wyn Griffith or Bob Simmons or someone like that, who, like, I don't mean this offensively, aren't in the same class as a Miles Harrison or a Nick Mullins, right? But they're quite, like, I would say, inoffensive commentators who are really good at their job, really good at just describing a game as it is, and occasionally might go, that's really poor that thing's happened, and say an opinion about it.
Like,
and it's fine, because it scans well enough.
As well. Like, you can just drop them in a broom cupboard and go, here's a game taking place in Parma, here are the team sheets. And they have a level of knowledge that means they will know 90% of the players anyway. They
Absolutely.
Have a level of professionalism that means that they will just deliver excellent, very listenable commentary that will just make sure the game is as good as the game is. You know, you'll never ever see a game that is ruined by, you know, like 100%. A commentator like a Bob Simmons, 100%. Like a Wyn Griffiths, like a Ryan Nugent.
Yeah. Who are just really good at their job,
yeah.
You know, and I'm really grateful to have commentators like that on the television. There's a point where Josh Lucy does a kick through for Jason Robinson to chase, and you think, you know what, pretty good decision. Jason Robinson, as we will get onto, is rapid, surprise, surprise. And on the commentary, he is the main commentator. As soon as he does it, he says, I'm really shocked and disappointed in Josh Lucy. I'm shocked that somebody as experienced as him would do something like that. Like, put a kick through for his rapid mate, Billy Wiz, outside him to chase inside the opposition 22. Like, what are you on about? And there's another point. They bring on Andy Farrell, and he says, oh, personally, I would have brought on Matthew Tate. I think he's a bit more creative than Farrell. No one asked.
Yep. When Lewis Moody comes on, he says, that's exactly what I would do.
Who cares?
Who gives a shit? It reminds me of, I remember we went to see the Under-20s play, Wales Under-20s played New Zealand years ago, and it was like a triple header. We went to see that in Manchester. And there was a guy sat behind us who was clearly with a bunch of his mates, and they were all like, group of like men in their 50s who'd come to watch the rugby. Fair enough, grand. But there was one of them who really wanted to show off he knew more about rugby than the rest of us, and would constantly bring up, it was like two players he knew. And he would be like, oh, that's, you know, that's Jim Mallander's son, actually. He's coached in the Premiership. And he'd constantly say, like, oh, he's a fantastic footballer. And he used the same three buzz phases over and over again.
Oh,
and he was so annoying because he was so sure of himself. And at least when I'm at a rugby, I have the good grace to say it under my breath. I'm not that loud.
Yeah.
As anyone who was, like, at the Liberty Stadium around me the other week, when I was moaning about the Ospreys not kicking enough, I was doing it under my breath.
Yeah, but yeah, there was a lot of really frustrating moments of stuff like that. And it's just like, I felt like that wasn't his role in this commentary team. They had him and David Soule, who I liked on the co-coms. I think that clearly he got sick of the man next to him by the second half. But like, he brought a lot of really good opinions to this, David Soul. And
yeah, and once Barry, like, tunnelled his way under Edinburgh to save a man's life.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
Of course he did.
To save Christian Raducanu.
Of course. I forgot that was him. But yeah, like, I don't know. Like, it's final easy point, for us as people who've never done commentary to get into the art of commentary, isn't it? And
but
again, of rugby.
I think this is a rare exception because it was so annoying.
Yeah.
And it, like, made a game that could have been, like, a 4 out of 10 game, made it into almost unwatchable dreck.
I think it was the intentions I didn't like.
Yeah.
Rather than the commentary.
My one final note is that, because the other thing is they keep mentioning Johnny Wilkinson.
Yeah.
It's constant.
Clearly they're told to.
I kept a count. By kickoff, they'd mentioned Johnny Wilkinson 9 times.
He didn't play.
He wasn't playing. He'd been mentioned more than any player on either teams. Like, they mentioned Johnny Wilkinson 8 times as many as they'd mentioned the USA.
And clearly, yeah, I say that's the directive, like, of ITV to do
they
that.
Mentioned Johnny Wilkinson more times than all of the USA team put together.
That's ridiculous. That is, I mean, we covered this before when we spoke about Martin Johnson sticking up for him. It's so unhealthy.
Yeah.
Like, they're trying to do that to Johnny Wilkinson because he is a much better player than that. Like,
but at one point, Ollie Barkley takes a penalty after about half an hour to put England 6 free up.
Yes.
And they cut to Johnny Wilkinson in the crowd and he is, like, politely clapping. And the commentator says, Johnny will be thinking, that's exactly what I would have done. He's a great reader of the game, is Johnny.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, he does read the game that, like, in the way that, like, if you kick it off the kicking tee and it goes through the post, that gains you 3 points.
Yeah,
he plans that out.
He'll be thinking,
meticulously.
That's exactly what I would have done.
He's done that so many times. Yeah, I'd have kicked it through the poles as well, actually. I would have not missed that one. Yeah, it's a good idea there, Ollie. Well done. There is a point where I look at the England attack and think, like, they need Wilkinson. There's a couple of points like that. And actually, like, are we getting into the game?
Yeah.
I feel like we are. Because, like, there's a point, like, shortly after kickoff where we go, wait a minute, we've got Sean Perry and Ollie Barkley as our halfback partnership. Not for England Saxons, for England
it
in the World Cup.
Ollie Barkley at 10 was the thing that really threw me. That really
Not
shocked
even at
12. Me. That was like, no.
I didn't even realise he had a stint of being, like, one of their big hopes as a fly half for England. And I've liked Ollie Barkley. I've liked watching it, like, his latter career kind of stuff for Bath. I always had really good memories of him, and, like, it was a player I really enjoyed watching, but I didn't see this coming.
The thing that really shocked me to discover, right, was Ollie Barkley was 6 years into his Test career at this point.
You're joking.
He made his debut for England in 2001.
So he would have been in contention to go to the World Cup they won.
Yeah. Like, he was not, I assumed when I saw this, it was like, oh, promising youngster Ollie Barkley. No.
A lot of people will listen to this and go, like, oh, these bloody Gen Z rugby fans, like, weren't alive when bloody Ollie, like, Barkley started playing, which is literally what we're doing. Like, we're retrospectively learning this.
But he just turned 26.
That's wild to me.
Yeah.
Like, I assumed he picked up, like, 4 caps.
Yeah.
In, like, the
I mid- figured he'd been playing for about a year before this for England. And you'd think so from, A, the way that he plays.
Yeah.
And the way that they talk about him as this youngster who's, like, they're blooding to come through. I figured it was, like, a 21-year-old. But no.
It's like, we need to make some backup for Wilkinson, which is entirely valid. The thing about Ollie Barkley in this game, he makes a lot of line breaks, right? He makes genuinely probably 4 or 5 line breaks throughout the game, which are most of them really, really good. And he makes great decisions off the back of them. But I think, looking at Ollie Barkley in this game, if a fly half had that game now, you'd think it's really poor. Whereas actually, you think about it, like, for the time, that was probably a really, really good game he had.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, he made loads of line breaks. Like, did a couple of really good kicks. Like, he was pretty good off the tee. Got, what, 5 out of 6 kicks he was offered? So, like, you know, all round, that's a very good performance.
It's not bad, yeah. Ollie Barkley, also, the other string to his bow beyond being a fly half come centre, was that he started, shortly after this World Cup, contributing to an online magazine. This is his other big thing. An online magazine called Blokely.
Okay.
Which is a good leading point. It's founded by a man called James York, who billed himself as Founder Bloke.
Oh, this sounds really
Their About Them page has an alpha gorilla. Because it's... Blokes! You love blokes!
These people all sound really secure in who they are.
Absolutely.
The amount of gym memberships in this on this website must be...
Mate, the amount of links they got for Christmas.
Yeah.
He says, I've never found a men's lifestyle brand that truly reflected my views, showed honesty, and maintained a positive tone towards men. So I decided to make one, Carpe Diem.
He's definitely out there, like, preaching for men's equality and equal rights for men.
Really sounds it. So their regular contributors, here it says, include XFM's Dave Berry, England rugby player Ollie Barkley, comedian Josh Howie, ex-England cricketer Ryan Sidebottom, and actress Kellyanne Lyons. And we're not stopping there. We've got more people in the pipeline.
Hold on. They've got a woman in there?
They've got a woman in there.
Holy shit. To talk about men's problems?
It's bloody woke nonsense.
This is so woke.
We strive to be the best men's lifestyle site on the web. We strive to be honest, open and engaging. Not waste oak loads of paper. Treat our readers with respect. Cool. Focus on what it means to be a modern man. Consider what girls want from us men. Not what women, what girls want.
I feel like I'm listening to the Egg Chasers podcast.
Avoid salacious or brainless content. Definitely not Egg Chasers. Yeah. Evolve where print magazine mere mortals cannot. Okay.
Please do not avoid brainless content. Please keep listening to our podcast.
It's pretty hard to find Ollie Barkley's actual articles for him, right? Though he wrote one on grooming and his grooming routine.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Can you tell me about Ollie Barkley's grooming routine?
I can't find the article, I'm afraid.
Gutted.
There's an interview with Josh Widdicombe, which unfortunately was not by Ollie Barkley.
Would have been great. I cannot imagine a more contrasting dynamic. The thing about Ollie Barkley is he probably wouldn't get that anything he was saying was a joke, but then he'd probably come out and go, he's actually quite funny, to be fair. So yeah, he's a comedian.
Yeah. Again, there's film reviews, and I can't find... None of them seem to be by... Ollie Barkley.
Okay. You know what's really interesting?
Ollie Barkley didn't do the review of Breaking Bad that they posted.
I'm gutted. It's really interesting, actually, because, like, as I say, I've always been quite a fan of Ollie Barkley, but I don't know how much of it is tainted by him not going to see Paul McCartney.
Well, that's the thing. Can you please tell us about that? Because this is an Ollie Barkley deep dive.
We did briefly talk about this with Ben James on the last series.
Okay.
But for anyone who's not listened to that, there is a video out there of Ollie Barkley saying that he'd got offered tickets, VIP tickets, to see Paul McCartney's side of stage at Glastonbury. And he turned them down because Paul McCartney is so old. But it wasn't only that. Like, he was offered side of stage because his barber is Paul McCartney's tour manager's brother or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he said, oh, mate, we can give you side of stage access for Paul McCartney's set. Legendary set. Like, already, 6 months on, has gone down as, like, one of the most, like, well-renowned Glastonbury sets of all time. Literally one of the... He was in the Beatles. Did you know that?
What?
Ollie Barkley.
No way.
I mean, Paul McCartney was in the Beatles. And they said, like, oh, yeah, so you take it. Did you go and see him? He was like, no. Like, of course I didn't.
So he's 80. What's he going to do? Do you want something great?
Go on.
There is, of course, on Blokely, a review of Paul McCartney live.
You're joking.
Which is basically, like, he's really great, and then you will be an idiot to disagree.
Yeah. Up yours, Ollie Barkley.
So
yeah, I feel like that's really clouded my opinion of Paul, not of Paul McCartney, of Ollie Barkley. Just the fact that he turned that down. I said this before when we had Ben James on. I waited 5 hours at the front of that stage for it. Like, I'd have bitten Ollie Barkley's hairdresser's hand off for that.
So I've found one piece by Ollie Barkley for this website.
Okay,
right? I found one piece intact.
All
There's
right.
only one piece that the Wayback Machine is able to salvage, which is Ollie Barkley. 3 days in the life of a professional rugby player.
Okay. This sounds interesting.
Okay. I'm just going to read the start and then we'll skim over the rest. I haven't read this in full. Facebook, coffee, tweet, coffee, a few weights, coffee, tweet again, some analysis on shiny new computers. Facebook, eat enough food to sink an armada, tweet about it, then bet. I want to point out that his use of capital letters is all over the place. Chatting to various people from all walks of life. Over the years, I've got a pretty good idea what it is that 80% of the rugby public think constitutes our working day. Over the next 700 all words, I'm going to straighten a few of you out.
He loves caffeine.
Yep.
That's for certain. It's coming across both in his insane intake of coffee and also just the way he's writing.
So, Ollie Barkley, I want you to bear in mind, is Alan Partridge as I read you this next bit.
Okay.
They say the only certainties in life are death and taxes. Well, for me, there's a third. My ongoing battle with the snooze button.
The best thing about that, that's a really good turn of phrase.
It's so Partridge. No matter how early I go to bed the night before, I wake up like some sort of orc from Middle Earth. A morning person I am not. I used to roll out of bed at 8:15, neck a protein shake and the recommended pills for the day, and rattle my way to Bath University for a 9 a.m. start. These days, in order to get the maximum possible, training looks very different.
I feel like he just literally is the guy off Don't Drop the Egg.
Yes. My main meal of the day now consists of a smoothie of skimmed milk, oats, frozen fruit, mixed nuts and protein powder, which, after going in a blender, is ready to give me just about the right amount of proteins, fats and carbs I need to put on muscle mass and weight from training. Nick Abenderden makes poached eggs. There you go.
Okay. That scans.
Yeah. He was living with him at the time.
Okay. That also scans.
You know what? His writing is not as bad as I was expecting.
Okay,
but,
fair enough.
I mean, his grammar's all over the place, like, but you know what?
That's what caffeine does to you.
There's a bit where he's talking about how much he regretted watching The A-Team on ITV2 last night.
Okay. Not manly enough for him?
Not manly enough for him.
It's a real shame, though.
Just, it's all incredibly Partridge.
I didn't see that bit coming of Ollie Barkley being a bit of a Partridge, but fair play. I mean, him writing for a men's magazine is already a step further than I expected.
Okay, so Ollie Barkley would, at the end of each of his columns each week, right, he would finish with his track of the week.
Okay.
This was his own idea. This was not included on any of the other columnists.
All right.
So, his track of the week for this week was Strobe by Deadmau5.
I don't know the song, but... Again, Ollie Barkley being into Deadmau5 doesn't surprise me.
It was only a matter of time before the inevitable reared its head. For those of you that follow me on Twitter, you'll know I have an unhealthy passion for everything Deadmau5 touches. It's not easy for me to pick out a gold medal from his vast collection, but Strobe is a piece of progressive house genius. Okay. Turn your phone off and lock your missus in the basement.
Oh my
Strobe
fucking
is
God,
worth
what?
It!
Oh my fucking God.
Ollie Barkley. That escalates out of nowhere.
Shit. Oh my God, I didn't see that bit coming. He's really passionate about that song, to the point at which he's holding his wife hostage.
A bit at the end of his column where Ollie Barkley announces, just admits to being one of the Philpotts.
Oh my God, he's locked his missus in the basement while he can listen to a bit of Owen Lentz. Yeah, wow. Jesus Christ. That took a really unexpectedly sexist turn. And I know that this magazine is very much for lads.
It's for lads. What can you say?
But, oh my God. I thought he would draw the line at, like, I am addicted to protein shakes.
Yeah.
Rather than, like, I'm going to lock my missus up. Jesus Christ.
His previous track of the week was Groove Armada.
Okay.
Sun Toucher.
Okay, I don't know that one.
Over the years, Groove Armada have pioneered a unique combination of funk, electronic and house, supplementing their melodic tunes with guest vocals from one end of the musical spectrum to the other. Fair play to you, Ollie Barkley.
Yeah, don't mind a bit of Groove Armada. What's that song called? Super Stylin'? That's a banger.
Yeah.
And isn't Groove Armada who do that? I see you, baby. Shaking their
neck. Oh, is that them? Right, okay.
That seems like exactly the sort of music Ollie Barkley
That's exactly what I was expecting.
This is such a deep dive.
He talks about how the World Cup was really big for growing the audience of everyone and, like, for the amount of sponsorships and so on. Talk about this 2007 World Cup in this article.
Okay.
But I'm skimming over that because I want to see his other track of the week.
Yes, I want to see a third track of the week.
And then we will move back to the game.
I feel like I should try and guess it based on those first two. There was what kind of era is this? Like,
this
is
from 2011, these
2011.
Weeks.
Oh, no. Oh, to be fair, no, I won't bother guessing.
In February 2011.
I bet he's into, like, David Guetta or something like that. That would be like or like Martin Garrix. It would be something like that.
I'm going to kick this off with one of my favourites. It's not often that the remix is better than the original.
Oh, dear.
Jump in if you ever know and work out where I'm going. But Reva Starr has outdone himself on this one. You can find Reboot Enjoy Music on Deflected Records, a unique bass with the best vocal I've heard in years. Make sure your bass is ramped up and your neighbours and missus are out.
So, we've also learned he lives next door to women.
Yeah. Tell you what, bloody Ollie Barkley, right? His missus hates music.
Yeah, she does.
His missus, as he refers to
also,
it.
Also, he hates his missus.
Yeah.
That comes across very heavily. He published this publicly. Like, she would have probably looked at this and gone like, oh, Ollie, it'd be good to read some of your article. Like, it's really good, you know, being supportive.
He's like, yeah, skip the track of the week bit.
Sorry, Ollie, this is really nice, but the bit about you planning to lock me up, can you just explain that for me, please?
Do you have to do it every single time?
I just really like that song. Do you have to publish the details of the box?
There's a weird bit about tonguing French women in this piece as well.
Oh, so let's not do that.
Let's not do that.
Well, maybe another episode.
Also talks about James Haskell tweeting about the Louvre. No, he isn't.
No.
He's mostly posting about how he's done more for women's rugby than anyone else ever.
I think we should put a lid on the Ollie Barkley deep dive for the time being.
I absolutely agree with you.
Maybe another episode, eh?
We've got to talk about the game then, haven't we?
We've got to talk about
the
game.
It's bloody shit.
Like, we've danced around it for like an hour, but yeah. It is shit. One of the first notable things, I mean, as you say, there's an exchange of penalties. Mike Kokkis goes to this really ambitious one from 45 metres and just strokes it over really casually, which is pretty cool. Yeah, they get 6-3 up. And, like, the first time I got, like, a remote, like, buzz in the game is when they first give it to Jason Robinson.
Yes.
And, like, he doesn't actually go forward, but he beats, like, four defenders. Jason, I'm like, Robinson, oh, please, just keep giving it to him.
Jason Robinson getting the ball for the first time is a great punchline.
It certainly is. It certainly is. And, like, every time he got the ball, in fairness, it just felt like, we do not deserve you in this game.
No.
Billy Whiz.
The other moment of standout in that first half is when it's 6-3 to England. Mike Kokkis takes an interception on the wing.
Yeah.
And you're starting to think, oh, this could be it. This could be the USA taking the lead.
Go, Kokkis, go. Like, you really cheer for him at that point.
And then, as you see the other players closing in, you realise, oh, if the USA did finish this, then Ruddy Dart would never have finished posting the clip. It would be going on forever.
Yeah.
When the USA led England.
It's fascinating. Like, as soon as he takes that interception, you just think, where is Ngwenya?
Yes.
Like, you immediately just start scanning the peripheral, like, for Ngwenya. Because, retrospectively, we know that he is, for anyone unaware, he's probably the fastest rugby player on the planet at this point.
Yeah.
Like, and that may be confirmed in a later episode. But he's one of the fastest rugby players to ever live in the 15-a-side game.
Yeah.
Absolutely unbelievable. But just doesn't get there quite in time. Like, Kokkis has to kind of, like, arc and feel a little bit. And Kokkis, great player, not known for his pace at all.
No. And this was quite an old Mike Kokkis as well. He'd been around the block and slowed down by this point.
But, you know, you think that if Ngwenya, and if the USA get another intercept later in the tournament, Ngwenya might get himself into a position where he might be able to finish it.
We'll see. So he managed to get the pass to Paul Emmerich.
Yes.
Right? At which point, Phil Vickery misses the tackle,
boy.
Then sticks his leg out and trips him, and gets a penalty for it. Like, a penalty to England.
Proper professional foul. Like, you say he trips him, he properly kicks him in the leg to, like, properly finish him off. And I never like to do this when it's something that could potentially be dangerous, because, like, if you get away with something, that just makes it a try-saving tackle by the letter of the law. But that is actually dangerous and should have been yellow carded, which is where I kind of, like, draw the line on my stance on cheating, is if it's dangerous, which that was. But yeah, he completely gets away with it. Like, Paul Emmerich just has this look of, like, this is bullshit.
The other thing is, because of the TMO laws at the time that could only comment on tries, it goes up on the big screen, crowd starts booing, no one can do anything about it because the referee missed it in real time. And he goes over to choke with his linesman, like, are you going to tell me that you saw it at the time? And they're both like, well, we didn't.
Hypothetically, if you saw something, whether it's in the big screen or in real time, hypothetically though, do you reckon there is a chance that Vickery might have tripped that guy up? Just like, dunno, I'm not allowed to say.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Get the penalty and clear it. Like,
yeah, next thing I've written my notes straight afterwards is, this is terrible, why is it 1987 again?
there's a few points. Like, there's a point, like, they have quite a few attacks. There's one where they try to grubber in behind, you're like, oh yes, it's the first try, and they somehow blow it. Like, Wiles saves the USA. There's the USA centre, Vaha Asika, gets a yellow card for a really dumb, like, hands in the ruck
daft
thing. Like, I've no idea why he really goes for it. But what I have written down here is, Asika dumb yellow, but to be honest, it's just nice to feel something.
It's very much where I got to.
Because just nothing had happened at that point.
No, I mean, so as you mentioned, like, the first time the USA get the ball, and they set up, and Mike Kokkis is about 20 metres away from the ruck, and there's no one closer than him.
Yeah.
And so not only does this mean there's no threat at all, because everyone is so far away,
yeah.
No one is, like, offering any lines off him. It's literally just, like, hands down the line, but 20 metres back, so the defence has all the time in the world to walk up and just...
And it's such a long pass that you can just go up while the ball's in the air.
And I'll tell you what, I did not know much about Chad Erskine, the scrum half.
I had never heard of him.
But he is not the best passing nine in this tournament, I think it's safe to say.
He's not as good as George Gregan, I'll put it that way. If he had some kind of deception or something off him, that would have helped him out big time.
Yeah.
But the fact that it was just, as you say, Herker stood 20 yards away with a couple of people maybe running something off him, it just meant that four or five defenders didn't have to mark a space on the field.
Yeah.
And could all just mark up against him, fly up on him, steal the ball off him. It's the easiest thing in the world to defend.
So he was a Chad Erskine, the scrum half, was a South African who failed to get a contract anywhere in South Africa.
Okay.
And went to America. And clearly, like, there's a point in the second half where Herkus is waiting in the pocket to clear it, and he chucks it over his head and over the dead ball line, or towards the dead ball line, and he just sort of has to scramble, and, like, it's a nightmare.
Yeah, feel for him a little bit.
Yeah, but he was not a great passer. He was clearly playing above the level he was confident with.
And that's fine.
Which happens.
Yeah, it's a difficult skill. Like,
and they had Mike Petrie on the bench, so hopefully we'll see them develop one of their best nines professional era there.
100%.
But yeah, so they're asking a lot of him. They're asking not much of Mike Herkus, and nothing is going to come of that attack. It's so badly coached.
Yeah.
It just looks absolutely... And it's easy to say that now with hindsight, now with structure, now with everything that's developed in the last 15 years. But it's a terrible-looking attack that is never going to go anywhere.
No. And they never look like really breaking England down. Like,
the intercept is the only chance time in which they look like they're going to score.
Yeah. And that includes the one they do score later on.
Yeah.
Speaking of scores, should we look at the first try in the game?
Well, so... I don't know how it happens. So England make a nice little break, and Jamie Noon then trips up Josh Lucy, and somehow they score from it. Like, I looked down to wrote down, Jamie Noon has just kicked Josh Lucy in the leg and tripped him up. And then I looked up and England was scoring.
Yeah, yeah. I actually didn't realise it was Jamie Noon. I thought the sniper had got
Jamie Noon kicks him in the leg.
That's ridiculous. Josh Lucy makes a really nice break there. Yeah. Like, he's quick, he's really agile, steps inside a couple of men, and you think, yeah, go on, Josh Lucy. Like, you want him to finish that, but there's a good covering tackle comes across, and then they feed it out to Ollie Barkley, who has an unbelievable amount of time on the ball. Like,
no one
comes near him.
He has that time because Ben K buys it for him.
Oh, does
Ben
he?
Ben K times his run and then times the pass perfectly.
Okay.
Like, it's really great by Ben K. In a way that none of the England backs are able to do that.
Mm.
None of the England backs are able to bring the amount of time
I missed
on the ball, the way he arcs around last second around and then holds the ball up until someone commits and then picks it up. Really, really great by him. It's one of those moments where you can see, oh, that's why he goes on to be a really good analyst on TV when he retires, because he's capable of those sort of moments in his playing
career. Got a lot of time for Ben K as a pundit. Yeah. He's really, really good. Yeah, that's a really good spot. I didn't see that. But yeah, like, Ollie Barkley just has like 5 seconds to make a decision and eventually looks up, realises himself, probably without a call, that the crossfield kick is on, because there's like 3 men out there completely unmarked, and he crossfield kicks it, and I was delighted to see Jason Robinson being the one to catch the ball and...
Oh, sorry, I was thinking the wrong try.
Oh, were you?
Yep, I was looking at the other try afterwards.
I mean, they're basically the same. They both start with a Josh Lucy break.
Makes that up.
Oh, I realised the Ben K pass you mean now. I also have written down there, nicely timed pass by K. I also have written down that in the stadium they were playing, I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor by Arctic Monkeys, because that was like a fresh hit at this
Ollie
point,
Barkley,
2007.
His track of the week now.
Yeah, well, only if it's the remix, because
it's true.
Typically remixes better than the original, aren't they?
Yeah, that cross kick is really good option by Barkley.
Yeah.
Just really composed, accurate. Jason Robinson scores. Like I said, great punchline. Robinson gets the first try.
And that's it.
Second touch of the ball after half an hour.
Obviously
he scores.
Great the first time we've watched a World Cup game with Jason Robinson playing in it, that he scored the first try. That felt really fitting, because he's a player I've got a lot of time for and like can't wait to just see as much content of him as possible.
Yeah.
He's obviously brilliant.
Well, we've covered the next try then.
Yeah, we'll put the next try. That was scored by Ollie Barkley. Yeah, as you say.
That's almost immediately afterwards.
By Ben K. It's a good line by Barkley as well, to finish that off. There's a really funny point where Simon Shaw tries to take Igwenya on the outside. And you should probably guess that ended up with him going into touch.
There's
Simon Shaw.
The other thing that happens around that period is one of the worst moments of fullback in defence by Cueto, who I thought generally had an all right game.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
most of his England team are pretty shit, but Cueto plays pretty well. Yeah. At one point, Cueto fills in at nine, does a much better job than Sean Perry ever does in terms of both getting the ball out quickly and then the next phase he has a little snipe, engages someone offloads and creates the meterage. But at one point, the USA get it wide, right? And they get it out to Cecily Seeker, the right winger, who literally just jogs in a straight line. And Cueto starts backing backwards, like giving him room, when all he's doing is running in a straight line towards Cueto. Like, come up and make the tackle. But Cueto just waits and waits and waits and lets him get well into the 22. Like, he makes about 20 metres just because Cueto's like, do you want them? Do you want these 20 metres? Come and get them. Come and get them. He's running backwards.
Is that the one where Seacombe has the break and Jason Robinson makes the try-saving tackle on him?
No.
No, because that also happens where Seacombe makes that break and Robinson comes out of nowhere and dislodges the ball. I suppose in a way the USA did look like scoring there a little bit, but like no one's skinning Robinson, are they?
No.
Like, but yeah, that was a brilliant covering tackle.
But like the USA's ball was just so slow that they had about two moments where it was fast enough to get it going. Like,
it was kind of flukish at times, wasn't it?
Amateurish nine with forwards who aren't coached to create breakdown speed.
Yeah.
Like, I have seen triple rollovers where the ball gets out quicker than here.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. There's a point where, like, the ball is so slow that Mike Hercus just catches it about 45 metres out from the goal line, has no idea what to do, so just randomly attempts a drop goal. Mm. And in fairness, 45 yards out, blinding shot that
would have put them back within 8 points.
Yeah. Like, he was just beneath the crossbar. Like, unbelievable shot from 45.
But we're rattling through this game.
We are. We have to.
On the second half, there is a moment, there's a kind of a period where, after England's got both their tries, the first two tries, in the last 5 minutes of the first half.
Yeah.
And then they're kind of frustrated for a bit. They do manage to score again on about 50 minutes, where they just end up 5 metres out from the line. And Tom Rees taps the ball and doesn't score, but it's awarded.
What I have written down for that try is Tom Rees taps the ball and puts it down over the try line.
Yeah.
I think he does get it down. But like, the USA were extremely not ready for him to tap that ball.
No.
They were thinking like, oh yeah, he's definitely passing it elsewhere. And they were, it was a little bit like an under 14's defence marked against the biggest player. And like, Tom Rees punches above his weight. I think he carries pretty well. So.
But then he was supposed to be the greatest player of all time.
Was he?
Well, do you not remember this? Do you not remember the Tom Rees hype train?
No.
Oh, he was enormous. Tom Rees was basically seen as he will be England's Richie McCaw but then he kept getting injured.
I don't remember that at all.
Oh man, wait until Lee and so on are on this. Like,
okay.
No, the Tom Rees hype train was one of the biggest you've ever seen for a forward.
Jeez.
He was enormous.
Because
key player in that Wasps team winning European Cup with Warren Gatland early on, like really early in his career. And he became, as a youngster, enormously hyped up, but ended up only really, I mean, his last game for England was 2008. Like, he played for England from 2007 to 2008, and then was just never fit to get back in the team.
Oh, wow. I mean, I vaguely remember that kind of thing. I just don't remember the hype train at all.
Yeah,
Was it, like, bigger than the Jack Willis hype train?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Enormously bigger?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It was, for the Jack Willis hype train is sort of, he should be playing for England, but we know we've got Tom Curry, who is better than him.
Yeah.
Like, this
what
was...
What about the Sam Simmons hype train?
Oh, nothing was bigger than the Sam Simmons hype train that he brought on for himself.
Yeah.
But yeah, just had endless, endless knee injuries. It was the same knee over and over again that kept reoccurring.
Right.
Eventually retired in 2012 at quite a young age, and is now a doctor at Basingstoke and North Hampshire Hospital.
Oh, sweet. Good for him.
So clearly spent enough time in hospitals and went, I like this.
Yeah, yeah, I can get used to this. Or already am used to this.
Yes. But then, as I say, so Tom Rees scores England's third try on 50 minutes. The other two having come in the last few minutes of the first half. And that is it.
That's it for England just doing anything in the game.
Yeah.
Like, they basically shut down at that point. Until Andy Farrell comes on.
Yeah.
And Andy Farrell does a couple of things that...
There's a moment around the hour mark, so around 10 minutes after the try, where the USA have had most of the ball and have done nothing with it. They've had a lot of ball in their own half where they've just done nothing and they've just kind of chucked it around one or two phases at a time, not look threatening at all. They look broadly useless. But the commentator says, England have been very frustrated by the bravado of the USA to hang on to the ball or to have the ball, which is one of the most insulting, patronising bits of commentary I've ever heard. I mean, the bravado of them not to roll over and let England score these tries.
How dare they actually oppose their opposition? Do they not realise they are England? They are our team?
It was just like... Because the USA hadn't really done anything. Like, these were two shit teams
out-shitting
each other.
Like,
yeah.
And as I say, like, they defended all right.
Yeah.
For the most part.
It
Watching how shit the USA are makes you wonder or realise why they wanted the Super 8.
Yes, of course. Oh, God. Let's not go back to the Super 8. But yeah, you're right. Like, that's a really, like, horrible way of viewing, like, oh, these guys have turned up. But, like, they don't realise that they're just meant to be our whipping boys. Like,
yeah.
They're meant to be, like, the equivalent of the missus you lock up in the basement.
So you can listen to Dead Mouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the thing is, I think, and they mentioned this a few times, like, they'd seen Australia and New Zealand absolutely smash their competition in the days leading up.
Yeah, do you think there was an air of jealousy to it, maybe?
I think so. I think there's an element of, like, well, we're like them. Why aren't we like them?
Yeah.
But also the fact, I think England had lost to France in two warm-up games, then they lost to Argentina. And suddenly it starts to look quite dodgy, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That's really, to be fair, it is a really interesting opening few games we've had of this World Cup, isn't it?
Mm.
To say that three of them have been... You always know which team's going to win it.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting that when you put that in context, because there is probably to certain aspects of ITV's rugby coverage, it has happened before where there's been like an almost superiority complex.
Yeah.
Of like England are above everyone else. I mean, I can call out Clive Woodward. Like, that's a fine thing. He's obviously one of those. But clearly that's a narrative that they're almost like told to go with.
Yeah.
You wonder if this was, if that message needed passing on in this instance.
So, the other thing, England bring off the bench a guy called Peter Richards.
I've never heard of Peter Richards.
I wrote in my notes, Peter Richards is shit and also who? I had no idea who he was. And when I looked it up, he's got a mildly fascinating footnote career, right?
Right.
In he was first called up by England in 1998, but didn't win his first cap until 2006.
Oh, interesting.
So he was called up by Clive Woodward, right, in 1998 as a youngster playing for London Irish. Brian Smith's London Irish at the time, you know. And he then, right, he played against New Zealand Maori and was potentially in contention to be on the bench against the All Blacks as kind of there. It was famously the England Tour of Hell where they lost every game. They got battered by the New Zealand Maori, you know, and then all-time biggest loss to Australia, which Clive Woodward seemed to overlook when he talked about Eddie Jones's lost the Springboks being the worst ever in English rugby history, forgetting the fact that he lost by like 90 points to Australia. So it was during that tour. Peter Richards then went out clubbing in Sydney after they played Australia two separate nights. Clive Woodward first time sat down was like, don't do that again. He went out the next night. And he was like,
what a guy.
He was like, all right, fine. I'm not. Look, that was your last warning. It's fine. You'll play against New Zealand Maori when we get to New Zealand and that'll be it. Then you want to keep your head down and behave. He then, the night before they played the New Zealand Maori, right, he went out again in Auckland.
I think Peter Richards just became my hero. The moral of the story is, if Clive Woodward told you to not go out clubbing, what do?
You go out clubbing.
You go out clubbing, obviously. So, like, Peter Richards just, every time he walks into Clive Woodward's office, it's opposite day.
So Peter Richards then gets in after the game. Sorry, it was the night after, whatever, it was during the week. After the New Zealand Maori game, but before they play the full thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he goes out again. A third time, Clive Woodward's told him not to go out and he's gone out, right? Clive Woodward, that then due to fly to South Africa for the final leg of the tour to play the Springboks. And Clive Woodward goes, no, you're flying home instead. So
he can go out at home.
Yeah. So Peter Richards flies home, doesn't play for England in the entire Clive Woodward era. Because he went out there.
He just loves going out.
Yeah.
He just loves going out so much. He prioritised over playing international rugby. I love the thought that he brought that approach everywhere with him. By the end of that tour, Clive Woodward was having to say, don't make that tackle. So we would have to make tackles.
Well, yeah, so he then gets dropped and it isn't until Andy Robinson takes over. No, until Brian Ashton takes over that he actually gets called up and ends up playing. Because Brian Ashton was like, mate, love this guy.
I think Peter Richards got called up after Lawrence Dallaglio made himself available, so they could both go out clubbing together.
Yeah, he could take all the Romanian restaurants.
Exactly. Like, Peter Richards clearly sets a lot of money aside to spend on drinks, clearly.
Lawrence Dallaglio's got a lot of drinks to buy, and Peter Richards got a lot to drink.
Precisely. And look, it was a big round, 30 grand that Lawrence Dallaglio spent on his round of drinks. And I can only assume that Peter Richards was a member of his party. Evidently, he must have a strong tolerance for alcohol if he's going out three times in a week on tour in international rugby. That's heroic, man. I'm so in awe of that. That is some proper, like, imagine if Finn Russell wasn't world-class and he was a scrum half you never heard of from London Irish in the 40s. Like, how great is that?
So yeah, that was Peter Richards' career. He also spent a spell during
he's become my favourite player in this team.
So shortly after Clive Woodward re-signed a new contract with England, he signed for Benetton and played for them for a bit. Just like, well, there's no way I'm getting the England team. Might as well go out in Italy instead.
That's hilarious.
Then yeah, came back Wasps and then Gloucester and then went back to London Irish to finish his career.
What a brilliant guy. He feels like he accidentally turned up to the wrong World Cup. He wanted to play in the 1987 tournament. Yeah. And turned up, and his TARDIS had landed him in 2007. She's like, oh, well, I don't know what to do about this. I'll just go out.
The thing is, he was definitely a dickhead.
Yeah,
but in the context of this English team, what a hero!
What a hero! Like, imagine the looks Andy Farrell was giving him when that was how he was preparing.
They were sat next to each other on the bench.
Exactly. And Andy Farrell going, like, being such an intense bloke. And, like, you look at how Owen is, like, you don't get that from nowhere. That's not by coincidence. Yeah, yeah. He's, like, all, like, you have to prepare in the most meticulously driven way that you possibly can. Peter Richards just goes out. Has a few bevs.
He does one of the worst dive passes I've ever seen in my life.
It's really funny. Clearly he had a few tequilas before he did it.
Please, so talk us through it.
It just felt like really like his hips were not synchronized with the rest of his body.
Yeah.
Like, it just felt like he began the motions of a dive pass, forgot how to do it, and then just kind of like winged it the whole way. It was brilliant. He manually moved his arms, then his shoulders, then his hips, then his knees, then his lower legs. It was fantastic.
It was just like he goes for the knife and he just drops it in front of him. It's very, very good.
I forgot to mention the trajectory of the ball.
Yeah, which just lands in front of him. Like an inch in front of him. It's terrible.
It's brilliant because there's a moment of confusion where the USA then pick it up and just go, did you really just do that? Like, were you meaning to do that? They have a moment where they're like, they pick up the ball and almost stop like it's rude to have the ball. Like, you did that. That was clearly an accident and an honest one at that. Do you want this back? Almost.
So nothing happens for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the USA, with about 5 minutes to go, might even be less than that. It's in the pretty much the final play. Like, yeah. Well, not the final play, sorry. Final 10 minutes.
Yeah.
They end up in the 22 through sheer fluke. Yes. Like, it's just England making mistakes on their own rugs.
It is as soon as they sub Jason Robinson and off, which about, I know has nothing to do with it.
But yeah.
It's a happy coincidence.
The thing about how deep Hercules is stood is everyone is going in isolated to every single tackle. So their ball retention is probably like 10%. They're losing about as many rucks as they're retaining.
They play this weird formation, and usually formations are based on forwards and the way they run. But instead, this is an all-inclusive one called 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1. And then there's the halfbacks.
And then the halfbacks, yeah. Got to link it all together somehow.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone else is just clearly scattered to just run a random line off Hercus. And then they forget that if the plan fails and they get tackled, they then have to do a breakdown. And they clearly did not prepare that far ahead in training.
England go off the feet at one breakdown, the USA kick it downfield, they get turned over immediately,
yeah.
But then England do a terrible clear out on their own ball, and the USA somehow flute the way onto the 5 metre line, at which point Dallaglio just goes like, well, I've had enough.
Even before that, can we just address Mike Hergus's tap penalty?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Where he goes for it. He could literally pick his method of scoring. He could pass it, he could do anything, and then he just goes, I'm just going to run into the opposition's biggest player, Joe Worsley.
So he's kind of looking, he's like, well, there's definite space next to me, and everyone drifts off him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he goes
he doesn't get much help, I'll give him that.
But you can see him think, in real time, oh, there is space for me to score here. If I don't give the pass, I shall not give the pass.
Yeah.
I shall throw a dummy instead.
Runs
I shall
into Joe Worsley
now.
Instead.
Yeah, which is exactly the time that Joe Worsley needs to cover 10% of the gap.
Yeah, exactly.
And he runs into that 10%.
Because fun fact about Joe Worsley, he's fucking huge.
He hits hard, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Really hits people.
The Lawrence Dallaglio fun time.
Mm.
Do talk us through it.
So, shortly after this, like, England just gave away one penalty. They're about to give away another on their own try line. Dallaglio just goes off his feet and he's like, I'm just going to lie here, mate. I'm just going to lie here, guys. I'm done. So the referee's like, no, I've had enough. He kind of, all the England players walks away. And he then goes into his pocket, pulls out a yellow card. And England like, who's it for?
And Delalio just goes, I'm off. I'm going. Peter, you coming? I'm gone. Look, yeah. I've got 30 grand worth of drinks to buy. I'm going off. No, Delalio walks off looking disgusted with the referee. Like, he looks so angry at the fact that they've had the insolence, the audacity, the bravado to send him off. Him, Lawrence Delalio. At one point, also, the commentator just says, Lawrence Delalio, like that. And I thought they were inviting him to comment because I'm just so used to Lawrence Delalio commenting on every game. So yeah, so Delalio gets sent off. He heads off and sits in the sin bin, and immediately the USA score for the line-out.
The Delalio walk of shame is really quite something, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a real spectacle to watch that. There is just a real... There's a moment where, like, you just look at him and just go, you twat, what have you done?
I was eating as that happened, and I yelled with a full stuffed mouth, "Way, get gone!" which was fun.
But yes, Moe Akiola scores on debut. Yeah. He drives over and he's absolutely buzzing.
Yeah.
I love his response to this. And just generally the USA is like, you know, it's good that somebody's excited to be here. But yeah, no, that was great.
And then they cut to Lawrence Delalio and he looks so disgusted.
Yeah, my fault.
He looks like unbelievably angry to be involved, to be there. Like, how can you let this happen to me, Lawrence Delalio?
But yeah, Moe Akiola's like spin and grounding are both really good. Like, he does a really good job to finish that try, so fair play. The commentary say that the USA deserve a try, which on balance they probably do.
I don't know if they do. I don't think anyone deserves a try. This game should have finished like 9-6.
They deserve a try for putting up with being there.
Yeah.
They deserve a try for the fact that they've been through 75 minutes of this.
True.
So they might as well have something to show for it. Like, it's a token gesture,
yeah,
that try.
They then kick back off. Paul Emmerich commits a murder.
Spear tackles Ollie Barkley and gets a yellow card.
Properly disgusting tackle. It's horrible.
Do not go and watch that.
No, seriously. It's like, it's one of the most violent, scary, like, could have paralysed Ollie Barkley. Yeah. He wouldn't be able to write his columns.
That's one of those that I'm shocked he got yellow. Like, because the commentators even said back in 2007 when it was barely.
Yeah, yeah.
So that has to be a red. Like, yeah. How on earth is he giving a yellow for that? And they were spot on. Like, in any age of any sport, that is a red card.
Like, it's so violent that you wonder if Paul Emmerich was secretly in love with Ollie Barkley's missus.
Yes, exactly.
Wanted to stop locking her in the basement all the time.
Exactly, just sticking up for her, you know. Just like, he'd clearly been listening to loads of Dead Mouse while that try was being scored.
Yeah.
Just like, oh yeah, I've got to commit a violent act on Ollie Barkley now. We've all had that. Every time we've listened to Dead Mouse 5.
England then kick downfield, and the game goes on for 83 minutes for some reason.
Fuck me. Why does he not want to finish?
Referee Jonathan Kaplan, who I prepared some stuff on, but we're not going to do it because we've talked for too long.
Yeah.
Nazi Jonathan Kaplan, as previously discussed, he just goes, well, I don't want to finish this game. I'm having a good time. It's a terrible,
good that
horrible
you
game.
Are, mate.
Yeah, so I might as well just drag it out a bit longer because I am a Nazi. And eventually he blows for full time and we all go, thank God, and turn the game off.
Yeah, the one interesting thing that happened towards the end of the game was Andy Farrell making a break and offload. And me going like, oh wait, he has the same running style as his son, obviously.
Yeah.
But that's hardly like a groundbreaking piece of insight.
Yeah.
But yeah, eventually Jonathan Kaplan finishes the game. It's like, thank God, it was terrible. Mm. Should have blown it 5 minutes early, mate.
Should we quickly do Dick of the Day, Man of the Match?
Let's do it. Where do you want to start?
Let's do Man of the Match first.
Okay.
I think the only thing in this game that is not terrible is the English scrum.
Oh, okay. That's a good call.
So I think the English scrum goes really well. I think otherwise, all of the England backs play badly, broadly. Quaita plays okay.
I wouldn't say they all play badly.
No. As a unit, they don't function.
Yes.
As a unit, the England backline attack doesn't function. As a unit, the English kind of carrying doesn't function. The English lineup doesn't really function. The USA lineup doesn't really function. The USA scrum doesn't function. The USA's backline doesn't function. The USA's forward carrying really doesn't function. But the USA's kicking game doesn't function. England's kicking game basically doesn't exist. Barkley does not kick at all, which is a problem. As I spend a lot of time just like aimlessly playing around the halfway line. The only thing I think functions well is England scrum. So on that merit, I could give it to one of the front row. I feel like they probably deserve it. But I also think probably if I'm picking a play, if I was doing like player ratings, the player with the higher rating would probably be Benke.
I thought you might say that. I think that's fair enough.
So I think, shout out to both England props, but I think it's Benke for me.
You weirdly might have taught me around there, actually. I didn't really think about the scrum aspect of it as picking my match. Literally, I've written down maybe Josh Lucy because he makes two breaks.
That's true.
And that's like, he did two positive things, which in this game is a difficult thing to kind of pick out. As I said at the start, like, Ollie Barkley was extremely involved, did a lot of good stuff, made loads of breaks and stuff. As I say, these days, like, I'm inclined to look at his performance and go, like, that's quite poor. But actually, for what it was in 2007,
I suppose
it was good. The one player, I'm not giving him the match, the one player, I was extremely grateful for Jason Robinson in this game.
Yes.
Like, whenever he got the ball, he looked like something might happen. So I was going to give him man of the match, but I think you've taught me round on the whole thing about, because the England front row were completely dominant.
Yeah.
And there is no doubting that. So yeah, man of the match is Phil Vickery. Cool. Sure.
Yeah, I can go for that.
And like, he looked competent in all of the other stuff he did around the park, which he wasn't really asked to do much, I suppose, around the park. Like, England were meant to have like a decent structure, and Phil Vickery as captain did a good job. So sure, he's man of the match.
Yeah. Dick of the day. I don't know where to begin.
So I, for the whole game, I had written down Ollie Barkley for not seeing Paul McCartney at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
But then something happened with 5 minutes to go. I saw Lawrence Delalio walk off and I literally wrote down, yeah, go on then. He's dick of the day. It's Lawrence Delalio, because yeah. It's just like, oh yeah. Well, I've got an excuse to give it to him now.
Can I nominate one dick of the day?
Go for it.
I found the BBC's live blog coverage of this game, and they, before the game, their featured comment was from M3A2C7.
Okay.
Right?
Sounds like
who
an expert.
Said, I'd say 50 points is almost certain. The England's second 15 put 50 points on the Eagles at the start of the summer, but I expect the Yanks to play out their skin today. However, there would definitely be at least 50.
Was that Harry the dog?
I hope so. Yeah, there's a bunch of all of this being like, oh, England were a nightmare, but they're going to be so good today, etc., etc., etc. And it all goes horribly badly from there. So, I mean, the dick of the day contenders are all the way through the team. I think, frankly, Mike Hercus has enough disastrous passes and kicks and so on that even though he both doesn't play badly, but also he's like, they're individual moments.
I know what you mean.
Chad Erskine, I think, has a few really rough passes. But I think you then look at Ollie Barkley. You look at Jamie Noon for ruining a try by kicking Josh Lucy in the leg.
That has to be up there. I've just realized I'd give a man of the match to a man who...
Yeah, got away with it. Yeah. Saved the one try-scoring opportunity yeah. as they had.
Go on, carry on. Jamie Noon. I'm tripping up Josh Lucy. He's about to score.
I think that would have been my leading contender, other than the players, right up until Lawrence Delalio gets sent off. And that is so funny that I am nominating Lawrence Delalio as my dick of the day.
It's just so on brand for the podcast that the first game we see of Lawrence Delalio, we both have to give him dick of the day. Like, we've chatted a lot of shit about him before, because... Let's be honest, right? He's just an easy target, Lawrence Delalio.
Sure. I mean, it does mean he's now tied as Dick of the Tournament with Clive Woodward.
I did consider him. I will admit, he had no involvement in the game, but I did consider him.
So, that brings us through. Are we done?
Yeah,
are we done?
I reckon
we've talked
so.
For far too long about a dog shit game.
Yeah, we have.
Please join us next week when we'll hopefully be joined by another guest. What a tournament.
What a tournament. I can't wait.
All right. We'll see you then. Until then, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.